All right, so today I have Cody Peterson. I found him. I got the Chiron Publications. They do an email newsletter, and they sent out a newsletter for the release of his recent book. It is The Shadow of a Figure of Light. And so he was kind enough to send me a copy, and I read it, and now we're going to talk about it. So, Cody, thanks for joining me today.
Yeah, man. Thanks for having me. Glad to be here.
Is this your first book?
Yeah.
Yeah, well, congratulations. Like that's a big achievement to write something like this and have it published and talked about in the Jungian community.
Yeah, man, it is. It's been a, I mean, it took 5 years to write it, so it probably should have taken two. But I'm not like a highly educated individual. So the writing process for me is quite laborious. But I got through it and had a great editor, and I was really stoked that Chiron agreed to publish it. I got Murray Stein wrote a blurb for me,
I
which made
saw
me happy. And I
that.
figured if I got him to write a blurb, then maybe his publishing company would agree to publish it, you know? So
How
once I
did you
got
get
his
him?
blurb, well, yeah, so because one of his, I guess, colleagues and a person that he, Stephen Herman, I don't know exactly what their relationship is. I know they're friends and they write some stuff together. So Stephen, Dr. Herman, he's in the Bay Area. He mentored me during the process, and he helped me make some the historical connections that I had made between Jung and Alcoholics Anonymous. Not like that connection wasn't already there, but I was able to kind of add a little bit to the narrative, I guess. So Stephen had helped me, and he wrote the foreword, and so I think that was because I emailed Dr. Stein and said, "Hey, Stephen Herman wrote the foreword to this book, like and he was really friendly, and he said, "Yeah, send me a copy." And literally the next morning, he's like, "Here you go. Here's a blurb. I love it."
Oh,
So,
wow. Awesome.
yeah,
How
man.
did you get to know Dr. Herman?
So it's very interesting because so a lot of times, like within the 12-step community, I would tell like certain individuals that I was writing a book. And one day my friend said, "You know, it'd be interesting would be a book about Carl Jung's or the relationship between Carl Jung and William James." And I was like, okay, whatever. And then I Googled it like within a couple days, and Dr. Herman popped up. So I bought his book. And then often what I do when I get these when I get when I order these books from the psychologist, I go straight to the index and I search Alcoholics Anonymous, because I like to know how keen they are on what's taking place within the 12-step fellowships. And Dr. Herman had some snippets in there, and he talked about it. He actually said something. He said something really profound that I, it what really struck me. He said Alcoholics Anonymous is one of the largest organizations in the world, and that is a really insightful conclusion, because you can't really Google that information. But if you know anything about 12-step meetings and stuff, in any major city, like in the United States, there will be, anywhere between 1 to 2,000 meetings per week in each in these cities. So it is quite a widespread community. And I thought, oh, that's pretty interesting that he knows that. So I reached out to him, and we ended up working together. And yeah, and then he, about a month into that, he turned me on. He said, "I just feel really, really inspired to get to l let you read this essay that I wrote in 2014 about Jaime D'Angelo and Carl Jung." And I read the essay, and what I was just blown away by was just how like clearly alcoholic Jaime D'Angelo is. I think it takes an alcoholic slash drug addict to be able to see that, because of all the sort of, the quote unquote normies that I've talked to, like, often they're like, if they know anything about Jaime, they'll say, "Well, I thought he might be an alcoholic, but I didn't think it was any big deal." The reason it's a big deal is this, because Jaime took Carl Jung to Taos in 1925, and Jung had a pretty big awakening in Taos. It's where he says he discovered his own myth, and which is a big deal for Jung. And then, and the connection, which is most fascinating, is that in 1926, really kind of right on the heels of this big spiritual awakening that Jung had, he met one of his patients named Roland Hazard. And he famously told Roland Hazard, you know, I can't help you. You have to have a vital spiritual experience, which at the time was a groundbreaking prescription, right? Because Freud was all about science. And so for Jung to actually, you know, humbly admit that he couldn't help this guy and then sort of send him on his way to go have his own spiritual awakening was a big deal. And Roland would later become one of the major influences for Bill Wilson, who was the founder of Alcoholics Anonymous. So Alcoholics Anonymous has always sort of honored the legacy that Jung left, you know, through Roland Hazard. But to bring Jaime DeAngelo into the narrative really puts it in perspective of what Jung was thinking and what was sort of at the forefront of his mind when he met Roland Hazard, the alcoholic, because Jaime was such a raging alcoholic that there's no way that Jung wasn't struck by his alcoholism. Jung was actually treating Jaime's ex-wife. They were getting a divorce. There was a custody battle. And then Jung's good friend married that woman. And they all, so there was a lot of sort of, interrelationship happening. And, you know, and the thing about Jaime too, is he's such a colorful character. He was, you know, sort of the grandfather of the beatnik movement. All the beatnik hippies loved him. They quoted him. He was just really an outrageous character, really a mythological figure in his own right. I mean, everything that's said about Jaime is written by some of the greatest poets of that generation who just adored him. And so, so he really has, you know, so yeah, it's been fun to be able to kind of, and thanks to Dr. Herman, right, is he gave me this essay. He told me I was free to quote it and to use the references. And so I was able to put this little narrative together. And that's how that happened.
Yeah, yeah. Well, so when you say that you're not highly educated, you mean like institutionally, huh? Because for you to, it sounds like you've done a lot of reading and you've, I don't know, like in the book, when I was reading it, I was thinking, man, has this guy read like all of Jung's works? Or like, I don't know, man, because it sounds like you've got a lot of knowledge about a lot of this stuff.
Yeah, I appreciate that. And yes, I mean, I'm not institutionally educated. You know, I think I have sort of like my wife is always telling me she's like me, though. She's not institutionally educated, but I have an academic mind. Yeah. So I, you know, I wrote the kind of book that I would want to read. And it's funny because luckily I sort of have been able to garner a little bit of Jungian readership. But for the most part, it's the 12-step fellowships that I'm kind of telling this story for. And it's ironic because there's not a lot of, there's not a lot of intellectualism within the fellowship. So I wrote a book that doesn't really fit, you know what I mean? But you know, the thing is once I discovered Carl Jung in, I think it was like 2018 when I finally decided to read one of his books for myself, I just was blown away. Because I felt that he was describing a process that I had been through. Right. Which in his language would have been, you know, he would have said, of course, you know, it's an archetype. It's an archetypal process. Right. And I've just been fascinated ever since. I mean, I wrote the book, so I kind of took a hiatus from doing a lot of reading. But the minute I published the book, like I'm just right back into the collected works. I'm reading the Psychology and Alchemy, Alchemical Studies, and Mysterium Conunctionis kind of back to back right now. Cool. And trying to do some dream work, you know, just with in my own kind of just for my own development and whatnot. Yeah. So
that's awesome.
Yeah. But I love Jung. I love the way he just ties it all together, you know, just from every tradition. And yeah, it's great.
Yeah, me too. When I told someone else, when I read Jung, I feel like he puts words to all of the things that I've never met anyone else or been able to come up with those same type of words myself. Like, he's the only one who speaks the language that I've never heard, but I've always known was there. You know what I mean? I don't know. It's
Yeah. I love that.
I had never known the connection between William James, and I never knew that Bill Wilson read William James. And I also never knew the connection between William James and Ralph Waldo Emerson. I really like Ralph Waldo Emerson. And I've thought before, I see a lot of like parallels in thought between Ralph Waldo Emerson and Carl Jung. And it might just be that they both read some of the same people or were influenced by the same people. But I've wondered how much Carl Jung was familiar with Ralph Waldo Emerson and his works and writings. But so I thought it was cool to find that William James was connected with Ralph Waldo Emerson.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's something about that American connection, right? You know, Dr. Herman talks a lot about how when Jung, he loved the United States because it's so spacious here. And so he would just, you know, on a whim, hop on an ocean liner and come across the ocean and come and visit the States. And that's actually when he came in 1925, Jaime heard that he was here and was like, "Hey, I got to take you to Taos. Like, let's go." And so Jaime, he kind of pulled some strings and they allowed Jung to come, even though he was a European, you know, and so, you know, I mean, Jung went to the Grand Canyon and then they hopped in like a 1924 Chevrolet and drove across the desert from Flagstaff out to Albuquerque, which it's just this wide open space, you know? And so I think that, you know, it's interesting that William James is the bridge, like, between Emerson and Jung. And there's something about Jung that's quite American, I think, in his perspective. The way he sort of was, I mean, Herman coined the phrase spiritual democracy, which I think is really telling, because that's kind of what you get in William James, and James's whole thing about the psychology of religious experience, right? And bringing this sort of spiritual kind of ideal into psychotherapy. And then of course Bill Wilson is along the same vein as well. I mean, his the spiritual democracy is one of the best descriptions I've ever heard of sort of what takes place in the 12-step fellowships. And so I think Jung was really he was really moved by that stuff, you know. And it's pretty interesting to think, like, you know, Dr. Herman tells me all the time that the European contingent of the Jungian fellowship doesn't necessarily understand the role that America played in his psychology. That's more being discovered by the American contingent, right? Because for them, he's just a European that visited the States a couple times. So,
yeah. Can I take you back a second so when reading this book, it does have a very intellectual aura around it, and I really appreciate that. I like that. And at the same time, I remember I'm working in a SUD program right now, and most of the people that I see are from rural towns, the country, and maybe they're not high, you know, highfalutin intellectuals or whatever you want to say. And so I'm thinking about the reaching how best to reach them. And I think with so much of this book and this way of thinking. I think it's very applicable. I was just thinking, like, I think this book is going to reach a certain audience. So I guess you mentioned you kind of wrote it for the kind of the 12-step program and the people there, and that in some ways they don't really map on to that, to the way that the book was written. I guess, do you have any thoughts on bridging that gap, or almost like this is absurd, and I don't mean it the way that it's coming out, but I don't know how else to explain it, but almost mm-hmm. writing the same book but in different language for the 12-step program audience? Does that make sense, or do you understand where I'm coming from?
It totally makes sense, and it's something I think about all the time. You know, in hindsight, I sort of look back and again, like, the thing is, I wrote a book that I would want to read. Yeah. And if I pick up a book, I mean, I'm reading Carl Jung and I'm reading Joseph Campbell. And if I'm going to read fiction, I'll probably read Shakespeare. Like, it's just the stuff that holds my attention for whatever reason. And I've had a, you know, I mean, the challenge has been for me, even just in my own sort of individual recovery, is how to bridge the gap between these ideas and an audience, like in a speaking engagement in a 12-step meeting. And I've thought a lot about trying to rewrite a book that sort of can, you know, not only just appeal even just to, like, more people, like in the 12-step fellowships, but just even, like, how do we present these ideas to the world at large? You know, there's so much to be had here, you know, and it, just in terms of, like, self-help and just spirituality, you know, there's so much, you know, I like, that there's, you know, Edinger talks, I think, a lot about popular religion and popular psychology, which this is not, right? This isn't the, you know, the happily ever after version of transformation, which I think on one hand tells a lot about maybe why it's not more well known, you know. Mm-hmm. I mean, individuation is not a widespread event, right? Yeah. It's just too difficult. So it does beg an interesting question as to what can be done with the message, who can accept it, you know. There's this great story. I can't remember where I read it, but at a certain point, a woman, I think like a poor woman, had come, like, made an appointment with Jung and had come into his office and was just blown away. Like, she was meeting Carl Jung, and Jung was like, he was really moved at this, like, whole thing, probably assuming or knowing that she was uneducated and was like, but just loved his works. And I think he, like, asked her about it, and the woman said, Oh, Dr. Jung, you know, your words are food for the soul. And his thinking was like, wow, there's no way she really understands, like, all of the nuance, right? Cause Jung is just, I mean, it's just insane how deep this stuff really is. But to the person seeking, right? Like, it's there. There's something there. It's speaking to the unconscious, right? Like, mm-hmm. you know, it's so fun. It's like awakening. Like, reading Jung is like waking up. It's wild. So
yeah.
You know, I've thought about trying to write, even just write a novel, right? Just and somehow incorporate this stuff. But I'm not a creative type, so. You know, coming up with stories is not my forte.
Yeah. So. Yeah. Yeah. And then there's always the, you know, a lot of people don't even really read anymore. So then it's like, well, how are you gonna? I feel like it would be so valuable for them to hear and understand some of this stuff. So how do we, basically, how do you spread the message? You know.
Yeah.
But I think it's great. Yeah, sorry. And another thought I had was, as you were talking about, you wrote this for the AA audience. I was thinking that's awesome. That I know that part of the steps is, one of them is or maybe not part of the steps, maybe it is. I'm not as familiar as you are with it, but is churning in service toward others and being that mentor and support for them. So I think this is a great, yeah, you living that out.
You know, it is in a way, right? I mean, it's something I find quite interesting just in that I've noticed, I guess, in the Jungian community. And Dr. Herman talks a lot about vocation, right? And meaning that spiritual vocation, right? The avocation or the avocation or whatever, is that there, so many of the Jungians are writing books, you know? So it's like a tradition, like to just put out a bunch of material and sort of share this message. Right. And so I can see why, you know, Jung just sort of, for me, like he just woke me up. Cause I'd always wanted to write a book since I was a teenager, really. And really this kind of book too. And then once I discovered Jung, I was like, oh, this is a book right here. It's so easy, you know, because the parallels between Jungian thought and 12-step ideology are just like, so there's so many, it felt like almost like easy. There's like low hanging fruit. Like my thought process was, I can't believe nobody else has really written this book before. Like, you know, so, but it, so it is, it, it becomes sort of a vocation and just, it's an extended meditation or active imagination, you know?
Yeah. Would you mind, I know you've done this on other interviews before, I'm sure, but for anyone who hasn't read the book and is hearing you for the first time, can you kind of lay out the, how you just said, the parallels between Bill Wilson and AA and Carl Jung and his thought, like the etiology there? Can you lay out what your book is about? And maybe even if you could start, I'm curious to know how you stumbled upon Jung. And even you said that a lot of what Jung said gave words to your personal experience. So maybe taking it a little further back, can you just kind of, yeah, lay it all out for us?
Sure. Yeah, to begin with, I think the parallels between Jung and Wilson, I mean, they really start with that historical connection, right? And then you kind of sprinkle in some William James and you have this sort of trifecta, right? And Wilson, he was just a guy. I mean, Wilson's own doctor, who worked at a rehab facility, basically said, if I could have turned you away at the door, I would have, because you were a hopeless case. But he got in there. And then when he was in there, his friend Ebby brought him a copy of William James's Varieties of Religious Experience. And then somewhere along the way, told Wilson about Roland Hazard's meeting with Carl Jung, and that Carl Jung had said, you've got to have a spiritual awakening. And Bill had a spiritual awakening when he was in the hospital. He had this kind of white light experience, is what he calls it. And then what he does is he just almost by accident, you know, he develops this program. I mean, he just one morning sat down to lay out the principles of the program or whatever. And he just came up with 12 steps. Like, it just came out of nowhere. And yet today, you know, as Herman says, you know, it's one of the, I mean, if you combine all of the 12-step fellowships, it's humongous. I mean, there's massive, I mean, like Narcotics Anonymous is huge in the Middle East. Like, it's huge. They have huge conventions with like 50, 60, 70,000 people. Wow, and their AA doesn't even exist over there because drinking alcohol is against the law. So the 12 steps have really, they're beginning to sort of infiltrate Western consciousness, right? Because, I mean, church organizations are adopting the 12 steps. You know, all religious kind of entities in one way or another are trying to use the 12 steps. There's Christian organizations based on the 12 steps now. So I guess all of that said, the 12 steps are sort of an archetypal, thing that's kind of emerged. I call them like basically a set of religious symbols. So almost like a new myth, right? And the the way, so what I do in my book then is I, coming from sort of a 12-step perspective, because I know sort of the jargon and sort of this, because it's really hard to attend like two or three 12-step meetings and figure out what's really going on there. It really does take decades, because there's this wisdom that takes place there, but it's kind of hidden behind, you know, in this weird language and stuff like that. But it's really this paradoxical language. And so what I do then is I try to demonstrate how the 12 steps are something like a modern myth. They're sort of a more psychologized version of a myth. Some of the symbolic film has been wiped away, but that the core symbols of a mythology are still there. You have the God image and the human being, right? And so the myth is really, it tells about the relationship between humans and gods, right? And the 12 steps show that, just like Christianity does, or what any other myth, right? And so by looking at the 12 steps from a myth, then we can apply Jungian theory to sort of unpack them. And what emerges then is really a sort of modern description of the relationship between the ego and the self, which is kind of how Jung would have described, like, the whole system of individuation is really based on that problematic relationship, and how the, and so, you know, what we, and so, like, one of the main parallels, I think, was how Wilson spoke of ego collapse at depth, right? And that alcohol had created an impossible dilemma that essentially ran his ego, you know, into the ground. And then what emerges from that is really, so that's that step one. We admitted we were powerless, that our lives had become unmanageable. And so then from there you do step two, and you come to believe that a power greater than yourself can restore you to sanity. So immediately this sort of deflated ego then has to return and look to the self in a different perspective, right? There's a separation between, you know, Wilson says that the ego, that we play God, right? And what Jungians say is that the ego identifies with the self, unconsciously identifies with it. So that's another parallel. And so the process of the steps then is to sort of reorient the ego in its relationship to the self, which is exactly what Jungians are doing and talking about. So you really have these two systems that kind of grow up out of the same traditions, which is, it's not an accurate statement to say that the 12 steps grew out of Jungian psychology, but more so to say that the two systems grew up side by side. And you have sort of the scientific side in the Jungian community, and you have this sort of more religious side in the 12 steps. And so that's what the book is really about, is just kind of to really look at all kind of these, the similarities and to really show how the 12 steps are kind of essentially like, taking a person along the same journey that at least the initial stages of like a Jungian kind of, not necessarily a Jungian analysis, but just the same, it's the same process of becoming more self-aware, and become like making the darkness conscious, right? It's kind of like shadow work, I guess, like is really a kind of an oversimplified way of saying the 12 steps help one to become familiar with and then hopefully integrate parts of their shadow.
Yeah, I think that's a very good summary. And yeah, that's all in there. How did you stumble upon Jung?
So I'd been familiar with Jung through my participation in the 12 steps, just because of the connection between, Roland Hazard, Carl Jung, and Bill Wilson. So, you know, most 12 steppers at least know Carl Jung by name. And then a little bit of college, you know, like, here and there, you know, but that's about the extent of it. But since I was basically in my early 20s, I've really enjoyed Joseph Campbell, who was a, kind of a Jungian at heart. And I was reading, I started reading a lot of Campbell again. I just really kind of dove in probably 2017, 2018. And he basically, I guess, convinced me to try Carl Jung. So the first book I read of Jung's was Symbols of Transformation. And I mean, you know, it's been like with Jung, it's a long, it's a hard road. It's like in the beginning, it was like wading through paragraphs of stuff I didn't really understand, looking for little nuggets of stuff that I did, but the nuggets were good enough to keep me engaged. And so, so now it's shifted. Like I'm actually enjoying like most of it, right? Like it's only little bits and pieces that I'm like, what the heck is this? You know? So that's pretty much, that's it. So Campbell turned me on to Carl Jung.
Okay. Yep. And would you mind giving kind of a brief synopsis of your personal transformation?
Sure. Yeah. I mean, it's looking at it from a Jungian perspective has been very interesting. I grew up in an alcoholic home, and I started drinking when I was 14 or 15. And essentially over the next, you know, I finally got sober, clean and sober in when I was 34. So essentially, it was 20 years of sort of struggling, within sort of the chains of addiction. There was a small, you know, 3 or 4 year period in there where I was able to kind of sober up, and I actually went on a Mormon mission. I went to Argentina. So, and I was kind of, you know, like Jung talks about an antiodromia. So I sort of swung all the way, from the darkness to the light, I guess, whatever. And was like a practicing Christian, you know, and reading the Bible. And that's when I first started wanting to write a book. And I got really kind of introduced to like academia, you know, because I would read, you know, the scriptures and the footnotes, and I would get commentary books and stuff. So, and I really enjoyed that stuff, but I didn't stay sober. So, and then, you know, 10 years of, I guess, going in and out of 12 step fellowships. I finally sobered up in 2013, and I basically become homeless and, was just really bereft and had sort of a real ego collapse at depth. I had like this, the moment, it was just this moment of clarity where I was like, wow, I'm 34. I don't have a job. I haven't seen my kids. I'm not paying my child support. Like everything was wrong. And so I really turned towards the 12 step fellowships with like a new sort of open-mindedness. The truth is that the 12 step fellowships really kind of put me back together. They got me on this kind of path that, people in the 12 step fellowships, you know, we all agree very often that the steps were the thing that absolutely we needed. That's kind of it in a nutshell, you know? There's a lot of different, there's a lot of like nuance and stuff in there, but no. I don't really, you know, it's kind of weird. I mean, that's the thing is that's why I was so drawn to Jung is because he describes this spiritual, you know, this, he calls it the experience of a terrifying process that works us rather than we it. Mm-hmm. And as I look at my life, I guess, like the arc of my life, that's what it is. It's been a terrifying process that for me involved, you know, alcohol and drugs. And that was a big kind of thing that allowed me to write this book. And I speak of the archetype of the alcoholic a lot. And because the image of the alcoholic is really a paradoxical image, right? Like, on one hand, like, you know, it's this horrible kind of thing. Like, you know, I've had, you know, my personal therapists have told me I shouldn't label myself as an alcoholic because it'll pigeonhole me and stuff. And now I can just hand them my book and say, no, it doesn't actually, because it's, there's also something of the transformation, right? I talk about in the book how the trickster, it undergoes a transformation and becomes the shaman. Right. And that's the process of the alcoholic in the 12 step fellowships. You know, we see these huge transformations that just, they're miracles really. And like you said, you know, once the person kind of morphs into a shaman, then they're able to carry the message, right, and help other people to experience similar psychic change. So
yeah, in that sense, would you consider yourself a shaman now?
Not really. I mean, no, because I'm not very good at it. You know, I mean, I'm more of like I'm the reporter, I guess. You know, I don't play a big role in other people's transformations, but I do have an ability to sort of describe what's happening, I think. So that would be
like Hermes.
That would be more my role. Yeah. I'm more like Hermes.
I was two threads of thought. I'm going to table this one because I have it written down. But the other one, your process, do you think that there was anything to be done maybe in your mid-20s or a few years before you had your ego collapse at depth? Like, do you think that there was anything that could have been done prior to that that would have helped get you on the path on the path that you are on? Not that it would be the same exact path, but, or do you think it just has to play out and everyone, I mean, you know what I'm trying to ask?
Yeah. No, and I think it's a really great question. And the thing that I guess my answer would be to sort of pull in this idea that I really kick around a lot, in the seminars that I do and in the book, you know, that there's the relationship between the ego and the self, is problematic to say the least. Hmm. And the myths that are sort of the renditions of this unconscious process, they're riddled with violence. So I don't think that for a person who's really called to the task, I don't think there's any way around the violence. Now that said, I don't think that everyone's called to the task either. Right. Hmm. And so, and in this sense, you know, we have these religious organizations and we have psychotherapy and stuff to sort of keep these energies bottled up. Right. But there's a certain kind of contingent of people who that it just doesn't work to bottle the energies up. There's no sufficient sort of expression of the unconscious. And so it just tends to bubble up in with neuroses and, you know, alcoholism and drug addiction are huge sort of conduits, I think, for the expression of the self through this kind of archaic aspect. So I do believe that for whatever reason that was just what I was called to the whole time. I don't think there was any getting around it. And what's interesting is, in spite of all the violence, that once a person makes the transition, then like what I see now is that the self there's kind of a depth of mercy and compassion and understanding and skill in bringing about that transformation that makes it worth it in spite of the damage that was done or that could have been done. So, you know, in the fellowships, like in the 12 step fellowships, it's heartbreaking because we see people dying all the time. I mean, you know, it just happened last week that a kid had come into the meetings and then, he just didn't come back, you know? And it's really hard to give answers and stuff, but the thing that that is, and this is where there's a wisdom in the 12-step fellowships that's really hard to see from the outside, but from the inside, we see the wisdom and we understand that there was nothing that could have been done. And it just, it almost seems like we, you know, maybe don't have sort of compassion or feeling for this, but we're so used to it. And we recognize that it could have been us. It should have been us, you know, in most cases. But that sort of like underlying, like Jung talked about it a lot. I think somewhere he says, you know, the unconscious has a million ways of snuffing out a person who's not willing to wake up. You know, at another point he said that, you know, the person who steps into my office for the analytical hour takes his life in his own hands. And we have the same sort of understanding of the 12-step fellowships, right? If you darken the door to a 12-step meeting, it's already become a deadly game for you because nobody wants to go to AA voluntarily. You know what I mean? It's the last. We call it the last house on the block for a reason.
Wow.
So,
yeah, that gave me a few thoughts. One was because there's like you talked about a lot of times the self is at work and it's trying to unfold this process, and perhaps sometimes we step in the way of that, and there's like this energy that has to, I forget the word you use, but kind of bottle up until it accomplishes its kind of mission. But I think there was somewhere where Jung said that had someone stopped Saul on his road to Damascus, he would have never become Paul, basically. And sometimes you just got to let it play out, I guess. That's kind of what came to my mind. It's almost like, I get what you're saying. It's almost, this is part of the process, and although there's a lot of violence being done and it looks bad now, we don't know the end result. And it's up to this person if they're willing to wake up or not.
Yeah. Yeah. Absolutely. The thing that's striking is that the self is willing to risk the collateral damage, you know, and that so often us individual egos are the damage. I mean, it's the quote by Jung, you know, about, you know, if something would have stood in the way of him getting to Damascus, I mean, there's pretty good evidence, I think, that Saul was participating in those martyrs of the Christians, right? And so that's the collateral damage, you know, that people were dying so that he could have this awakening. And that's a shocking kind of insight and revelation, you know.
Yeah.
But we, like in the 12 steps, we often say that, you know, our lives are built upon the bones of those who didn't make it. It almost sounds just uncaring and stuff, but you know, it's true. Like it's, you know, and it's, so it is, it's a very strange, I mean, it's hard to speculate because we don't know really what the unconscious, you know, wants or is trying to do or anything like that. But to me, it appears like whatever this thing is, it really wants to make itself conscious, and that it's really, you know, we're sort of just like pawns in this kind of grander scheme of, you know, increasing conscious awareness and of, you know, as Edinger would say, of the transformation of the God image.
Yeah. Yeah. There's something coming to my mind, but I can't remember the citation for it. So I'll have to skip that. But yeah, it's very, very interesting to me. There's what I wanted to ask, what I had it written down was, I kind of, like you said that your therapist said, you know, you shouldn't identify too much with the alcoholic. Like, don't, if you label yourself that, you're, but in some ways I struggle with that too. It's kind of like, it's like we all have identities or roles. And sometimes if I identify with one identity or role too rigidly or too much, Let's say I identify as a father, and that's my, I build my life around that. And I, everywhere I go, I'm like, hi, I'm fathered, you know, I'm a father to my children. And then my children die, then that's going to be like, that was my whole role. That's my whole, my identity is, I'm a father. So what am I now? Or how, and that's going to create this whole, so part of me kind of in that line of thought, part of me thinks, if I identify as an alcoholic, and even I know that they call them like sober alcoholics is a thing that they do. But like, if I'm part of me is like, to the extent that means I can't just have one drink, I'm going to have more. Like that's, I know that that's my proclivity. So when I say I'm an alcoholic, that's a reminder that I can't just have one. But I guess, I don't know, to me, like any further than that or forever identifying with that, it's, or even though that would be like, you mentioned the alcoholic and the trickster. I think the trickster plays a role, but to me, that would be like identifying with the trickster or like that's, you know what I mean? So that's my tension. And I was going to see kind of how you make sense of that and what you think about it. Yeah.
Sure. And I really appreciate, I love the question. I love the sentiment. And I think it's, there's so much meaning underneath it. That's that for me is just, is everything. And so I think that there's, when it comes to these, this particular complex, if we can call it that, then there's sort of this reductive way of looking at it. And if I were a therapist, I mean, because I don't think it's safe for everybody to identify as an alcoholic. The alcoholic is an archetype, and I think that I think there's plenty of evidence to support that notion. I mean, the fact that Jesus broke bread and gave his disciples wine. You know, there's a certain sort of spirituality that's tied in with intoxication. So my TikTok feed, for example, is full of people who are self-searching and they're eating ayahuasca in the jungles of Mexico. Right. It's everywhere. This, you know, intoxicating love. The culture is enamored by intoxication. So I think that an alcoholic is a person who experiences a spiritual bypass when they use intoxicating substances. That's how I define this complex of alcoholism. But I think one of the most telling kind of catchphrases, I think in like Alcoholics Anonymous, for example, is when a person says, my name is Bill and I'm a grateful alcoholic, right? Because who ever heard of someone being grateful that they're an alcoholic? Or, you know, I'm a grateful drug addict or whatever. So when we look at these archetypes, you know, Jung would essentially, you know, Jung demonstrates that the archetypes, they kind of have a dualistic nature, right? There's a lower and a higher aspect. And Jung was always talking about the highest and the lowest of this and that. These are sort of energy fields, right? And so just like with electricity, there's a positive and a negative kind of current. And when these are combined, they create power. I think the same thing takes place in terms of spiritual power, right? So the alcoholic then is sort of this conduit for spiritual energy. And I think that, you know, for a normie to go to Mexico and eat ayahuasca, that's perfectly fine. There's some spiritual energy to be found there. But I think that, the way most recovered alcoholics in Alcoholics Anonymous are using the term, like to say, I'm an alcoholic. I think what they're doing is they're referring to this archetypal, kind of strata. When they use that phrase, because and it may surprise someone to hear this, but they're not even really saying that just to remind themselves that they can't have one drink. Most alcoholics in recovery that I know, they never think about drinking ever. Like it doesn't cross their mind. And the story is told over and over again how, oh, my dog got hit by a car and I didn't even think about drinking. And the reason they say that is to really try to give hope to the newcomer who still thinks about drinking pretty much every hour of every waking minute. Yeah. Just all the time. Right. But what I think what is taking place in AA, for example, when they talk about being alcoholic is that they're, it's more a reminder of this, of the spiritual nature of their existence. Right. It's a reminder that they have this way of life because they're an alcoholic, right? That when a person says, they admit that they're powerless over alcohol, that their lives have become unmanageable. I mean, Jung said this. He was asked by a reporter in 1961 to define his notion of God. And he said, God is the name by which I designate all things which violently and recklessly enter into my life and change the course of my plans and my designs for better or worse. So I think when a person in AA says I'm an alcoholic, what they're really saying is that there's a greater wisdom in my unmanageability, and that is the very thing that leads me towards a deeper connection with God. So I hope that answers your question.
Yeah.
In a roundabout way, at least.
Yeah, no, that's helpful. It's helpful to better understand how you think of it and, yeah, what it means when you say that. Yeah. The last part here, I wanted to ask your thoughts on kind of the, when we're talking about, when we were talking about wholeness and the how there's the positive and the negative aspects of all of these different like archetypes and God himself, all, when it comes to the idea that kind of when it comes to like pinning down, because in AA, do you is there a portion where you come up with like, what are the attributes of God, or like the God as you know him? What are the attributes that can be subscribed to him? And my train of thought here is, so I'll just lay out my train of thought. There's a quote in the book where on page 104, Jung is writing and he says, to carry a God around in yourself means a great deal. He writes, it is a guarantee of happiness, of power, and even of omnipotence, insofar as these are attributes of divinity. To carry a God within oneself is practically the same as being God oneself. And so then I started thinking that sample there, insofar as these are attributes of divinity, my questions were to myself kind of were, what are the attributes of divinity, or what are the attributes of God? Are they whichever ones we subscribe to God? What about the dark side of God? And then is God love? And if so, is God also hate? Like trying to think about the wholeness there. So those were kind of my thoughts around that portion. And I was going to get your thoughts on it, I guess.
No, what a great question. I mean, this was kind of a big insight that I had while I was writing. And actually my therapist sort of helped me to kind of formulate it, which was that the God image that typically is projected is this image of light. Right. And you know, Bill Wilson and Carl Jung essentially are saying, hey, you know, you got to look within, right. That the image that the experience of God is found within, not without. And Western culture generally will tell us that everything good is outside of ourselves and that there's nothing good inside. And so don't even look in there because there's nothing good in there. And that's certainly the way I felt about it, because the last place I ever wanted to look for anything was in inside of my heart, tangled up in my emotions and my fears and my insecurities. So the way I want to answer your question is really just to give you my personal experience.
Okay.
Jung and Edinger both talk about how until we recognize the paradoxical nature of the God image, we can't really experience the self. And the way I sort of interpret that is to say that that whatever I'm thinking or projecting about this God image is going to be a reflection of what's inside of me. And so, it's tricky because if what I'm seeing as God is only good, then I would suggest that there's a part of me that's still unwilling to look at the parts of myself that aren't good. In other words, I'm sort of denying my own shadow. So if I'm denying the shadow of the figure of light, I'm denying my own shadow as well. And so the more clarity I can get about my own darkness and my own shadow, Wilson uses the term the great reality. Jung talks about the objective psyche, right? So it's seeing oneself in kind of as clear a light as one can, and actually for, you know, who we really are. The more I can accept myself, then the more I can accept sort of the darkness of the God image. That's kind of, and I love that quote by Jung. I kind of just put that in there because it's so sort of heretical, you know. I love that he's like, you know, it's kind of, because there's also the paradox of like over-identifying with the God image, over-identifying with the self, right? And then suffering from an assumption of omniscience, right? Which was my problem. So, but at the same time, right, the key is within. So, you know, it's definitely food for thought.
Do you have anything that you would like to end this with? Like, do you do speaking tours, or I think you have a website. I can put that in the video description. But is there anything, like any announcements or anything that you'd like to say?
So, no, just I would invite people to go to my website. If people are interested in picking up a copy of the book, you can buy them from me directly. Chiron has given me the ability to sell them as well, which I like. Or you can get them off Amazon or Chiron Publications. I do have on my website, I've been going through the whole book kind of chapter by chapter, and I put together some slides, and there's some fun kind of conversation after the presentations as well. So we're actually almost wrapping up. I'm doing the last, the conclusion will be this week. So those are all there. There's like 21 or 22 chapters.
Nice.
Yeah. So if people are interested in going a little deeper, or maybe in just having me explain more, like what exactly I'm trying to say, it seems to be, you know, people are enjoying it. I'm going to do a couple weeks on dreams too, just personal dreams that I've had since I wrote the book. I think, yeah, there's sort of an element of kind of the feminine that's missing in my book, which I'm aware of. I've been picking up on that since publication. So, and there's some interest in that group, to have me do, I'll probably do 3 or 4 weeks, and just talk about the anima and the divine feminine and dreams and Mercurius, you know, a version of the alcoholic that's all I would like to put out there.
Yeah, good, thanks. Yeah, and I'll link your website in the description. Cool. Cody, thanks a lot. I'm glad I found you. I'm glad I was able to read your book, and I'm thankful to be able to have talked with you today.
Yeah, thank you. I've really enjoyed it. It's always nice talking to people who have read it and who are interested. And I'm very, very appreciative myself. Thank you so much.